Great. Thank you very much, Glenn, for the invitation to give you a little bit of a talk here. I'm not an expert in either tenure or really publishing. I have experiences in those, spend a lot of time thinking about them, a fair amount of time thinking about them. So I'm hopefully going to give you a little bit of my own sort of perspective, and there'll be areas where some of you may well disagree with what I'm saying, but that might be good because it will foster some discussions. So I'm going to talk about how the relationship between publishing and tenure, and as I said, this is going to be a personal story. I'm not going to be able to, and that's partly because of what I'm going to say here is that it's a very intimate thing, that it's very discipline-centric, it varies very much across disciplines, and so I'm not going to be able to give you the whole story, but hopefully give you some thoughts about that we can talk about. I kind of like the idea of a little timeline, but you know, this is sort of science publishing and tenure, kind of where it all started. Maybe this is fairly familiar to people, but really, you know, the idea of science itself sort of grew up at the same time as publishing grew up. They kind of grew hand in hand. In the 1600s, scientists were called natural philosophers. They were just mainly people that really sort of grew up with the rise of sort of industrialization, I would say, people having time on their hands to think about things other than getting their lunch and dinner. So the natural philosopher came about, and the first publishing, I think, you know, looking around the place, the first sort of formal publishing would have been these what we call invisible colleges, which were these networks, mainly in Europe, because, the US was not really around that much. But mainly in Europe, involved networks of kind of what I would call proto-scientists. You know, the idea of science hadn't itself as a discipline hadn't really, or a way of thinking, was only just starting. And these were letters essentially exchanged across universities in Europe, and then published often in the form of books or shared. You know, the publishing itself was sort of rudimentary at this stage. So there were book publications. Then the first scholarly journals came around the latter part of the 1600s, the Royal Society and the French Academy of Sciences putting these first journals out, or the first scholarly societies. This was where these, well, you know, the letters that were sent from university to university and researcher to researcher were then, oh, well, we should meet as a group and think about how we might want to formalize this invisible college into something meaningful that we can sort of publish. And so the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, I think, was generally considered to be the first scientific journal in 1665. Then a lot happened, but quite slowly. More and more journals came along, disciplinary journals came along, Philosophical Transactions sort of covers everything, as it still does today, everything in science. And then what was being clear, right, the universities were becoming very big entities. You know, they were starting to get, the US was really getting important universities, and which are still dominant, some of the biggest universities in the US. But there were a lot of issues with sort of arbitrary nature of hiring decisions, such that you know, donors could come along and say, yeah, I just don't like that person, I'll build a new building for you, but I don't like that professor, so maybe you can get rid of him, we'll give you the money. So there was a lot of, and also administrations were, I would say, making decisions not really based on scholarly work, but based on hiring decisions based on personal preferences. And so this idea was kind of, Harvard sort of set, and Columbia and Chicago together sort of made this first step to say that donors can no longer dictate faculty decisions. At the same time, Dewey and others were thinking about freedoms, and this was really the American idea, American philosophy, if you like, of freedom, but also freedom in civil liberties, freedom in how to conduct scholarly work. And the AUP was born sort of on the back of some of these arbitrary decisions that were being made, and made this sort of declaration of principles of academic freedom and tenure in 1915. And that's really where tenure started. And so there is a quite reasonable connection between what the AUP is doing now, which is really to protect the academic freedom and tenure. I'll talk a little bit more about what they are, really. So that's how the AAUP came to be. Academic freedom, which we hold dear, you know, we're entitled to the freedom to publish what we like and where we want to publish it. That's sort of become enshrined in this whole concept, an indispensable quality of institution, actually the indispensable quality. Some people would argue that that is what makes the university a university. The idea of academic freedom is the university in some ways. So institutions, you know, the idea here is that institutions of higher education such as this one are conducted for the common good, not for the institution itself. But for the common good, the public good, and not to either further my interest as a researcher or the institution, which is interesting because it's a little different. You know, often that gets lost sometimes. It's the public good that we're talking about. And the common good depends upon the free search for truth and its free exposition. And this is enshrined in the 1940 Statement of Principles on Academic Freedom, which isn't all of that, but that's part of the, what we call the Red Book. So tenure, and this is from our own faculty, this is a national organization, American Association of University Professors, but from our own faculty contract code, it's a right of a faculty member to hold the position. Actually, there's a typo in this in the faculty code when I was reading this, but I've sort of corrected it. So tenure is the right of a faculty member to hold his or her position, not to suffer loss of the position or discriminatory reduction of salary, except for certain reasons. The reasons really are sort of do really bad things, I would say. You know, there are reasons why you would want to fire professors, and that's acceptable. We should have that condition. But one of the reasons, oh, he's just gone off, or she's gone off, and started the research, we don't think is right, acceptable. That wouldn't be acceptable, because that's the academic freedom concept that the tenure is aimed to protect. You know, I don't want to belabor the point, but you know, tenure is in some jeopardy, or has been in jeopardy. If you look at this time series, this is from our own faculty senate at the University of Washington. These statistics are from not the universities across the nation, but just our own. The fraction. So there's a sort of two ways you can play this. The fraction of tenure and tenure track positions is declining.
Yeah, it's not declining.
It's declining maybe 20%, 15% in two decades, or 15 years or something. But what's risen, though, but the absolute numbers actually have increased. So it's more that there's been another, the universities are doing work, doing research in other ways. And one way is that we've got what we call without tenure professors. Many of these are in the medical school here, but also research professors, there's a lot of similarity between these two.
There are people that don't actually teach for the most part, or some teach
some of the time. But the point is that these are positions that don't have the tenure associated with them. So these are rising quite fast. And so you know, there's
discussions that can be had about how tenure is changing over that period of time. But it's still fairly well held, I think, by the administration and by faculty. It's kind of held in high regard.
The requirements for tenure, so this is where we get into the publishing area. Really, tenure should be granted. So
what happens is you go through, and many of you will know this, but
for those of you who maybe not associated with universities, usually a professor would be hired as an assistant professor, and she may be hired for a period of 6 years, and in that period she has to show she's generating high scholarly output.
So tenure should then apply for tenure, should be granted to faculty members of such scholarly and professional character and qualifications that the university can justifiably undertake to employ them for the rest of their academic careers. It's a pretty big commitment that we have to make, that universities make to a faculty member. So there's a really high bar for getting tenure. And
the key thing is that assessment is made after consideration of this candidate's scholarly and professional character and qualifications. And that's, even though this is from our own faculty code, I don't think you would find it's all that different in most of the research intensive universities. This is where it starts to get vague or a little bit hard to pin down. But faculty codes tend to be vague about what the specific requirements are. requirements are for tenure. You won't see, probably, you need to produce 2 papers per year for 5 years. You won't see that written in the contract. Because and this statement of vagueness acknowledges, I think, that there is quite a large diversity of what constitutes scholarly work across disciplines. And it's not all in publications, and there are many ways in which you contribute, and books, even appearances on television, book reviews, many things can fall into this. And it also acknowledges that tenure decisions are really made at the department level. Okay, they're not approved at that level, they have to go the chain. But really it's colleagues within the discipline, within your own department, that are making those decisions. This person has got adequate scholarly output. So there's the vagueness here. So that's why it can often be kind of difficult to say, well, what do I need to do? And that's a dilemma for young scientists coming in, assistant professors. And what do they need to do? It's not that clear, and how is it changing? And I'll sort of touch on some of those areas in a minute. But in science, I would argue, and this is why people can throw other ideas, but I think the journal publication is the primary means for assessment, and there's both a direct way, obviously the publication list that you've got, where are you publishing, are the influential papers that are being cited, but also the letters of reference are very important. We have to go out, the department calls out 6 or 7 letters of reference for every assistant professor that's applying for tenure, and those letters have to come in and look pretty good, and have to make a strong case of why this person should be getting tenure. And obviously, when you're young, you're not all that well known in the scientific community. So the journal publication is also aware that these letter writers, other professors in other universities in similar disciplines, are getting information about your scholarly output. So there's both indirect and direct ways in which publications are important. So they're very, journal publications are clearly highly important in that assessment. Other fields, and even in science to some extent, scholarly books, book reviews, and other output can also be important. I sort of kept this focus more on science, partly because I know more about that, but also because this conference is scientific, it's focusing on the science aspects. Beyond publications, though, increasingly demonstrable grant funding. You need to also show that you can bring in grants. Now that's taking over as, but again, you won't probably find that written down in faculty codes or contracts. But some universities, and this has sort of hit the news a little bit, have been saying, oh, you're going to bring a certain amount of money every year, as a general average. Doesn't really fly at the University of Washington. You do need to list your grant funding, so that is important, but essentially, publications can also be playing into this in important ways because the ability to get grant funding is usually when you've written papers and you can show you're doing the research. So publications are important for that, especially in today's perhaps more risk-averse funding climate, that people want to see that you've also demonstrated that you can do this proposed work before you actually do it. And the letters of reference, and again, that's what I was saying, that's actually important. Visibility is also very important. And as we know, as we suspect, all journal publications are not equal, of course. Within a given discipline, there are generally journals that are given a high status, I would say. This is where it gets kind of very personal, this is a given discipline. So we're talking about what goes on in Department X and Department Y, they're going to be different, very different assessments. And I'll come back to that a little bit.
Objective metrics, these are on the rise. Obviously, with the electronic era, it's easy to generate, or it becomes easier to generate statistics, citation indices, impact factors. But they're not necessarily indicative of high status. And particularly because there's an acceptance that a journal's impact factor is not necessarily the impact factor of a paper in that journal. Right? It's a big variation of a journal's mean or average impact factor, and that of the particular players or authors in that contribute to that journal. So they're not necessarily indicative of high status, but I think increasingly so, demonstrating that an H factor is a certain level is becoming used. So there's certainly correlation, and there's certainly sort of desire to see more people being aware of citations as a But there's also, it's very interesting that just yesterday I had a conversation with somebody in my own department, even within a department or a discipline, there are differences. So if I go to a similar department across the other side of the country, they have a very different attitude to say whether you're going to publish a publication in Science and Nature.
Some places treat this as almost like, as soon as you've got that, that's it, you're going to get tenure.
This is not just a flippant statement. I've actually talked to people whose departments actually, more or less say, informally say that, that would get you, if you can get a publication on these journals, probably first author, then you're probably going to get tenure. That's not really the case in ours. In fact, some people kind of look down on Science and Nature a little bit as publications because of the tendency of these publications to
want to generate kind of newsworthy stories.
I have one publication in Nature Geosciences, one of the subsidiary Nature journals, that they really changed the title.
They just we're not going with that title, you have to change it.
So that's interesting, because that sort of goes against the academic freedom idea. But the point is also that some of the papers in Science and Nature tend to be kind of hyperbolic.
They try and make a strong statement and a newsworthy statement, and increasingly that's sort of seen as an important component of those papers.
And so Journal of Climate, which is has a lower impact factor, also can have more impact because you can do more detailed work. 30-page papers are not unusual in that journal, 20, 30 pages. And so you can do a more detailed study. So even within our department, across departments in the same discipline, there is a difference in the way in which different journals are treated. So it's a very intimate thing within and also even within departments. I don't know where I was going to put that. I'll come back to that actually. There's another topic that could fit here. Another consideration in publication time for tenure track,
these are the faculty of assistant professors looking to get tenure,
we call it tenure track, they view the time to publication as increasingly important.
Because if your tenure, 6 years isn't a very long time, presumably you've done a PhD and published some papers before you get the assistant professor positions, postdoc perhaps.
But you want to get as many publications or good body of work as possible. It's better to say nobody wants to see in preparation, manuscript in preparation, because you just kind of think, well, is that just a figment of somebody's imagination? How far along is that paper? If it's been accepted or published, that's it certainly adds, it's more important for a publication list than if it's just in somebody's mind, the paper. So the time to publication is really a big impact, a big thing in our field, and it's come down a lot. Some of the journals have really, really hurried up on this. Other ones haven't, and I think that they're losing out. The American Meteorological Society, for example, which is just one of the two major societies in my field dealing with American Geophysical Union, the AGU have really increased the speed of their publications, and I think they're really benefiting from it. The AMS have struggled to do that, and partly it's the electronic move to all electronic has been different in the two journals. So there's been, the publication time is really, really thought to be kind of important now. So that's one of the key things that I think is changing. And the response. And so which journals are seen to be important, are those where there's good paper being published? And so are people shifting more towards, top quality scientists are shifting more towards certain journals. That's sort of where this idea that certain journals have a higher status and some are being left worthy.
This is changing all the time. I don't think this is just changing in response to electronic media, but that's part of it.
I'd say proliferation of new journals, ask specifically about this, there's a lot more journals. I don't know, my view is that it's not having a huge impact on tenure erosion research intensity versus the larger ones, I would say. Partly because many of these new journals do not yet have the status, or are not considered high status, and so
people would tend to stay away from them,
at least initially. On the other hand, there are some journals that have risen rapidly in the last decade, that are taking over, and initially there was a sort of scepticism about them, but that changes over time as more and more high quality papers get published in there. I guess the message there is that those in the field sort of know quality. It's hard to put numbers on it, but they know quality when they see it. So if people are sending the papers that are from this particular new journal, that journal will get increased status among that discipline. So there have been some game changers. Electronic journals backed by scientific societies. So part of the problem is that many of these electronic journals are not really backed by a very, a scientific society with a lot of status. But some are. The European Geophysical Union, for example, have really made a massive change. They went to all electronic journals, new journals, discussion phase, open review, open access, and they've really just taken the market in many ways, and they've become, in 5 years, 10 years, have become a major player. And initially many were skeptical about this open review, the fact that everybody can see the reviews online, anonymously or otherwise. But many thought that would kind of lower the reviewing standards, people would be nicer or less critical. But I think that's sort of, can you quickly reach once publications by
well-respected authors begin to appear?
So some of the new challenges, I would say, are not so much in publication of journal articles, the classic scientific article, but in as our endeavours become more complicated. For example, I'll give the example of making a climate model, right? A model to predict the future climate. Incredibly complicated, right? You've got the ocean in, you've got the atmosphere, you've got chemistry, you've got clouds, you've got all kinds of different physical representations, all of which have been worked on by different people. Complicated beasts. Within those, there's software products, there's algorithms, there's data, scientific data sets, satellite data sets. The idea of how to publish these, typically they've always been published as a journal article, but it doesn't really make that much sense in many ways. So journal articles typically don't include lines of code, right? But there's nothing to stop that. So, how do we create ways of rewarding this? And to reward, I've said that publications are very important, so how do we reward aspects of the work that are not necessarily fit into this kind of general, this typical scientific publication approach? We need new avenues to publish these creations and include them. And there are moves towards that, and I don't know if there's been any discussion of that today, but and how we would evaluate them for tenure. We do need to think about that. So the idea, the conditions for tenure are changing. And how do we assess individual contributions within large collaborative publications? So as the fields mature and get bigger and projects get bigger, how do we, well, we've got papers of 50 or 60 authors, how do we know who's done what in there? And some journals have actually had explicit statements about who did what in a paper, mentioned being one of them. But that's generally not done in most journals. So we do need to think about that. How would we say what people have done when somebody's given, this was the example of my own department, of a professor who said, well, when he went for tenure, the college council, the people that get together, academics, and decide whether the application's worthy, commented that, you've got a lot of publications, you're the last author on all of these. And then he said, well, in chemistry, because he's an atmospheric chemist within the atmospheric science department, in chemistry, people put their names last. The lab boss, what's the name? The lab manager, the academic at the top of the chain, if you like, puts their name last. And so that was not, because the group was not familiar with that, then that got questioned. But luckily we've got a process where there is some dialogue between the applicant for tenure and the people who are assessing the tenure. So, we can get around that. But that is an important consideration, I think. I think the message really, a big message is, almost every aspect is decided by peers, that's scientific peers within discipline, journal submission referees are peers, letters of reference are coming from peers, department colleagues are peers. So the importance of peers, and that makes it kind of, there's a lot of diversity across different fields within science. So tenure decisions, the sort of summary is, tenure decisions are reached based on a complex set of evaluations, involving publications, but also increasingly grant funding. And as I said, the new challenges involved, like adapting to new technologies, we're all familiar. The idea of bigger projects, big data, how do we reward things that are not conventional publications, don't fit into conventional publications, should I say. And, you know, tackling complex problems, increasingly complicated problems, large problems, collaborative problems, and those are kind of some of the key areas. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Themselves on the departments in that way. And they, if that's
that's sort of getting the question a little bit. There was one at the front here, then one at the further back, so yeah.
You mentioned discussion papers when you were talking about electronic publishing. Could you kind of describe what those are and how they're viewed?
Yeah, I like them a lot. I published quite a lot in this particular journal for the European Geophysical Union. What it is that when you submit a paper, there'll be a pre-approval stage, you know, that the planning is not completed. You know, the editor will look at it and they'll say, is this reasonable? It doesn't have to be, it won't be peer-reviewed necessarily, but they'll have the editorial approval that it could go into this open discussion. And that, within 2 or 3 weeks, could be then published in a discussion. It's not citable in the sense that it's citable, but it doesn't go into the scientific indices. It's the discussion phase. Then the reviewers will get to comment on it, and those reviews will be posted over the next few months. And then it will either be accepted or dropped. You know, it will always say that there will always be that discussion version available, but it may not ever make it into the final version of that journal. So it allows research to get out there very quick. It's a bit like the archive in physics, which has been around quite a long time actually, where you know people would just, but it's within the journal. What they used to do is just put in these archives available for people to look at. But now the journals are sort of picking up on the idea and using it as a phase of their own publication. Does that answer your question?
Well, there has been some discussion in my area of, is it published? No, we don't consider it published while it's in discussion.
No, you can't cite it. No, you can cite it, that's the problem. You can cite it in a general publication, but that doesn't make it to these Thompson indices, though. Those papers that are discussion-based shouldn't really be counting towards, it won't count towards your age factor, for example. There's one more question.
You mentioned that articles, publications, journal publications, are important to secure funding, and along those lines, outreach is becoming increasingly important to secure funding. How does that play into the tenure process? Because you didn't include it as an important part. And I know it's not yet, but you know, are we moving towards that? And what are your thoughts on how important it is?
I sort of stay away from that a little bit, but it is becoming increasingly important, I think. It's becoming important to secure grant funding, but it's also seems to be an important component of communicating with the public, and that's something that was, you know, doing our research for the public good. You could certainly include that. It might not be considered, some of that is. It's scholarly output of a different type. I think it is becoming increasingly used, but I would say that on its own probably. Now, this could differ in universities, but not where your tenure is not based on research. Right? So here, most of the tenure decisions have a big research component. If you go to liberal arts colleges, there's tenure in those colleges, and the research output is smaller, but those kind of things can become increasingly important there. Because you know the outreach component could be a major factor, so it is becoming important. But I don't know quite how much weight is being put on that, and that might well vary by field as well. And I think it's increasingly been seen as an important part of the scholarly output.